Thanks so much. And thank you so much for inviting me and for putting together this fantastic conference. If you saw me last time I was here, I apologize that the first part of the talk will be rehashing some things that you might have already seen. I just wanted to say that, this is the kind of stuff that I get paid to do. There's metabolism and, networks of actual real neurons. So it's pretty neat that there's a conference like this where people from very different backgrounds are getting together to think about things and work together. So here's a brief outline of my talk with a big picture of my collaborator. I've broken my talk up into two parts. The first part, I'll talk about a connection between certain forms of deep learning and the normalization group. And in the second part of the talk, I'll talk about something called the deterministic information bottleneck, which is an approach to compressing relevant information that I've been developing with DJ Strauss, a graduate student at Princeton. So in this first part of the talk, all these ideas were done in close collaboration with my good friend Pankaj at Boston University. So very briefly, what is deep learning? I don't want to spoil the afternoon talk, but in a sentence, it's a collection, a very broad collection now, of techniques organized around the idea of learning multiple levels of representation. And it's all the rage because it's revolutionized basically everything, starting with things like speech and object recognition to now much more sophisticated tasks. And everybody's doing it, so so you should too, of course. Right, so this field began or was relaunched, say, about 10 years ago now, almost exactly, with this science paper by Jeff Hinton and his group, where they developed a novel way of training models that that employ layers of hidden variables that can subsequently be used for many things, for example, generating data, compressing data, and initializing weights for supervised classification tasks. And to understand, so this is the paper that got me interested first in machine learning, and I want to tell you about the critical insight in this paper that made what they were doing possible and relaunched this field. So for some years before this paper came out, people were trying to train something called a belief net, which is a network, an acyclic graph of stochastic variables, where you have a bunch of hidden units, and you might want to sample from these hidden units, and then once you get a sample here, you generate samples here conditioned on what you get there, and you keep doing this all the way until you get to the bottom, and the bottom is called visible, and that's a representation of your data. And you would like to use this model, to generate samples that look as much like your data as possible, so you'd like to do learning, and to do that you need to do inference. And it turns out that doing inference and learning in these kinds of models is difficult due to something called explaining away. So these models were of limited use for a long time. So what Hinton realized in this paper and related works was he could get something that looked a lot like that belief network with a very roundabout technique. And what he did was he started with something called a restricted Boltzmann machine. This is instead of a directed model here where you have arrows only on one end of each link, now you have arrows on both ends and you can write down the state of the probability distribution of this model with an energy function that looks like an Ising model. So you just have pairwise interactions between variables, and it's called a restricted Boltzmann machine because you only allow for interactions between the two populations, so you have a bipartite graph. And Due to the fact that you have these restricted interactions, you can trivially trace out the hidden units if you want and look at just the marginal distribution on the visible units, and it implicitly contains interactions of all different orders. So in a sort of efficient way, you're controlling all these different orders of interaction. With this restriction, you're also able to effectively learn these models with something that looks like an approximation to maximum likelihood, but not quite. You can fit these things pretty well. But this doesn't look very much like a belief net. So what Hinton did was he tried to stack these things. So he first took a restricted Boltzmann machine. He trained it. He fit the parameters of this. And then he froze the parameters, and then took every sample of the data, mapped it to a pattern of activity of hidden units, took that collection of patterns of activity from all the data, and treated it as data for a second restricted Boltzmann machine. Then trained the parameters here on this now data, which was the hidden units from before, then froze those, mapped it, did the same thing, kept on doing it as many times as he wanted until he was satisfied. And it's not entirely obvious, but what you get when you go through this procedure is a generative model of data that is a sort of hybrid directed undirected model. So at the very top, you have a restricted Boltzmann machine with a bidirectional arrow, and then from there on down, you have unidirectional connections down to the data. So you would sample first by collecting a sample up here and then doing a feed forward pass down here. So this is the procedure that was introduced in this paper 10 years ago and some related ones. And it works fairly well, but it seems quite ad hoc. You know, why is this a smart thing to do? It's not really obvious. And so Pankaj and I were thinking about this, and we realized that it's really doing the same thing as some old school variational RG that Kadanoff was working on in the 70s. So if you're not familiar with the variational RG, the way it works basically is you start with a microscopic Hamiltonian, and you introduce some coupling to some coarse grain degrees of freedom, and I'm going to call the coarse grain degrees of freedom H. And then by tracing out the microscopic degrees of freedom, you generate an effective Hamiltonian on the coarse grain degrees of freedom. And you would like to do this while keeping the physics the same. So you'd like to keep the free energy invariant, which happens as long as you satisfy this condition. The problem is that at the same time, you want to actually be able to do this trace. So you want to be able to make this analytically tractable while satisfying this. In general, it's not possible to have both these things at once. So you give up on keeping the free energy the same, and you introduce some variational parameters into your T operator, and you try to minimize the free energy difference or bound it if possible, so that you've minimally affected the physics. And you know, the way that this was done was with things like bond moving, but this approach was never really competitive for computing critical exponents to any accuracy, but it was still useful for gaining intuition, especially for students. And it may be that the sort of the approximations you had to make analytic progress were too restrictive. So it turns out that there's a very simple, trivial mapping between what you're doing in variational RG and what you're doing when you train a restricted Boltzmann machine. Both of them are sort of an iterative procedure, so we can just focus on what's happening at one stage. So with this identification, these two different approaches are the same, and it's easy to see also that the condition that you preserve the free energy in RG is the same in machine learning as fitting the distribution exactly, that is, having the Kullback-Leibler divergence between the data distribution and your model's distribution be zero. You can also see easily that the RG Hamiltonian is the same Hamiltonian as you would get if you took the restricted Boltzmann machine and you integrated out the visible units and looked at the Hamiltonian of the hidden units. So you can, you know, put together a table of, you know, what different things mean in each language. And the main difference really is that when you do RG, you know the distribution exactly. You have the Hamiltonian, so you know, in principle, you have complete information about the distribution, whereas when you're doing machine learning, all you have are samples drawn from some distribution that you're interested in. And this essentially forces you to use numerical methods entirely instead of trying to make analytic progress. So just to illustrate that this, you know, actually works, for fun, we took samples from the 2D icing model slightly above its critical temperature and did this layer-wise training of these restricted Boltzmann machines. So I trained, you know, one restricted Boltzmann machine that had 400 hidden units on a 40 by 40 icing model, then another one on top of that with 100, and then another one with 25. And you can visualize the results of the training by looking at isolating, say, a particular hidden unit in some layer, say, up here, and looking at its weights down to the next layer and composing them with the weights down all the way to the data, and then look at what its sort of receptive field in neuroscience would be. So each of these little squares is the receptive field or the filter that one of the units in this layer has. And over here, these are the different filters of each of the 25 hidden units in the top layer. So if you put these filters from different layers next to each other, you can see that you're getting a little punctate spot here that's getting bigger and bigger as you go up the network. So it seems like the model has sort of discovered a block spin RG procedure, which is kind of cute. You can also take samples from the data, map it all the way up to these 25 degrees of freedom, then map it back down and look at what it says, and it does a pretty good job of compressing and then reconstructing the original sample. Okay, so this is relatively brief. Some of the things that that I'm doing now with this that are too preliminary for me to show you are thinking about whether we can see evidence for this in trained neural networks. For example, if we look at the distribution of hidden unit activities as we ascend a network, can we see that there's a flow, for example, away from criticality? This would only be possible if the actual data itself was close to a critical point. And it turns out that many of the domains in which these networks work well, in fact, have been shown to look like they're close to a critical point if you think like a physicist, in particular things like images. Similarly, I'm trying to see whether, in fact, these deep networks are most useful for data near a critical point. So if you can take your data and then deform it in some way, do you see that the benefit of depth is revealed when your data is close to this critical point? OK, yeah.
For the icing model, you have a nearest neighbor interaction.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. So here, so as you say, all of the connections are between these layers. There's no lateral connections. But if you take you know data down here, map it all the way up, and then do that for each sample, you due to the overlaps, say in these filters, you generate correlations that you could potentially think of as being generated via interactions.
Yeah. I'm also confused because physics locality is a thing that we use.
Right. Yeah, so in this case, I would say that they are. Most of the networks that are used these days are what are called convolutional networks that essentially implement locality explicitly. And here I didn't use them because I wanted to see if the model would discover it on its own. And it did. I should make one extra note that that to get this kind of result, you need to use enough regularization that if, because you're using a finite number of samples, if you don't use regularization, you'll get filters that look all over the place. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to move on to the next part of the talk, but feel free to ask me about this stuff at the end. So in the second part of the talk, I'll discuss work by DJ Strauss. He's a graduate student at Princeton, and this is really all his doing. It's an unrelated topic, but one of the inventors of the information bottleneck recently wrote a paper connecting them, so maybe they're not actually distinct. But for me, I'm going to leave deep learning and study only shallow models. So I've essentially gone to the dark side for the rest of the talk. So the problem that we've been working on is known as the information bottleneck. And in this setting, we have some inputs, input data X, from which we would like to extract some relevant information. And that information is information about a third variable of relevance Y. To do so, we have access to the full joint distribution of X and Y. So what we'd like to find is some mapping Q of T given X that solves some problem that I'll discuss. And I will generally use P to represent distributions that are given in the problem formulation and Q for distributions that we're trying to find through optimization. Okay, so there are lots of different perspectives depending on where you come from for what this could mean. It could mean lossy compression with relevance if you're studying information theory, or something like maximally informative clustering if you're doing machine learning. And just to give you some example sorts of tasks that this abstract problem represents, you could consider, for example, something like user segmentation, where you have demographic data and past behavior of some users, and you cluster the users based on that information into some lower dimensional cluster ID, and you'd like to do it in a way to preserve information about the future purchasing behavior, clicking behavior of the users. Another task which I think about some is human attention and memory. So sensory systems in general are faced with the task of taking a huge amount of raw information, like think about all the pixels that are in your vision, and compressing it down into a lower dimensional space of neural activity. And this involves definitely throwing away a lot of information, and you might wonder what information should the brain keep and what should it throw out. And one hypothesis that's going around is that it should retain predictive information, that is information about the future state of the world. And this is a theory that's been put forward by Stephanie Palmer and Bill Bialik in a nice PNAS paper last year. I won't describe this slide, but just to say that if you look at data of real neurons in a real salamander eye, you find that it's that they're effectively solving this information bottleneck problem surprisingly well. So if that sounds intriguing, you should check out this paper. Okay, so let me formulate this problem more precisely. So we're given some joint distribution P of X and Y, and we'd like to find a mapping from X to T or this conditional distribution that minimizes some cost function that has two terms. The first term is meant to represent compression by minimizing the information between X and the compressed variable T. The second is meant to encourage the extraction of relevant information by maximizing the information that T has about the relevant variable Y. There's a free parameter beta, which sets the relative importance of these two terms. Small beta encourages maximum compression, while large beta favors retaining as much information as possible that you can about y. And there's also a Markov constraint, which basically enforces the fact that t only gets to see x, it doesn't get to see y. Okay, so this problem can be solved through usual variational calculus. When you do it, you get three equations and you iterate them until convergence, starting from some initialization similar to like an EM algorithm. The problem is not convex, so you'll get a local minimum, but you're not guaranteed that it's the global. The second and third equations are not so interesting. They just enforce the rules of probability and things like the Markov constraint. The real meaty one is the first equation, which is the equation for the encoder. And if you think about what this is saying, so Q of t given x is the probability that you should assign a data point x to a cluster t. And if p of y given x and q of y given t are similar, meaning that the data point x and the cluster t say similar things about y, then the KL divergence is small, and you have high probability of assigning x to t. If x and t say different things about y, then the DKL is large, and you have low probability. And also, the solution is a function of beta. So what's typically done is to visualize the set of solutions parametrically as you vary beta in what you might call the IB plane. That is, by looking at the information that you have about x and the information that you have about y, and plotting some curve. Low beta is near the origin, large beta is over here. And usually these curves saturate when you extract essentially, you know, all the information that x has about y. And anything in the shaded region is, you could come up with some encoder that would put you somewhere here. And this is the sort of optimal frontier. So this is the information bottleneck, and there's been lots of nice work and applications and this stuff. But what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the talk is an alternate formulation that DJ and I have been working on. And the motivation for this alternate formulation comes from the choice of compression measure. So in the original IB, compression is measured by the mutual information. And this is motivated by channel coding and rate distortion theory. So the mutual information between x and t is the capacity of the channel between x and t. So this metric encourages the tightening of that channel. And squeezing that channel is where the term information bottleneck comes from. This focus on restricting communication costs certainly has applications, but you could imagine other scenarios where you're more concerned with restricting the representational capacity of t alone. So this comes from source coding, where the compression is measured by the entropy of t itself. For example, if you were thinking about human attention and memory, this would more directly represent the number of neurons that you needed to perform some task. So it's instructive to look at the little difference between these two cost functions, calling the first one LIB and the second one LDIB. It's clear that the difference is just the negative conditional entropy of t given x. This is also called the noise entropy, and is a measure of the stochasticity of the encoder. So you might guess that DIB would be less stochastic than IB because IB seems to explicitly encourage stochasticity. And as I'll see on the next slide, DIB actually gives a deterministic encoder, hence the D in the name. Yeah. Basically, so the Q here, Q of t given x, is a probability distribution as opposed to a function. Yeah. So we'd like to replace the compression term with an entropy here, but trying to solve this with the same variational calculus approach fails. What you can do instead is generalize the IB to a family of cost functions just by putting an alpha in here. and solving as a function of alpha. So clearly, alpha equals 1 is the original IB problem. We would like alpha equals 0. We can't just do that. So instead, what we do is we solve as a function of alpha and then take the limit as alpha goes to 0. You can do that, and the solution looks like this. The proportionality here just hides the partition function that normalizes the distribution. And you see now that there's a 1 over alpha here, and a log q here as well. And if you set alpha equal to 1, the marginal just slides back out, and you get the original IB cost function. But if we instead take the limit as alpha goes to 0, you can see that the argument of the exponential blows up, and you end up with a delta function at the maximum of the exponential's argument. So you can see here that instead of having a q that is stochastic, has noise in it, you actually just get some function f of x. And it has a DKL that's similar to the solution to the IB problem, but also it now has this log q of t term, which encourages compression through assigning data points to clusters that already are large. So this is kind of like adds a little rich get richer scheme, if you like. And this solution is, again, iterative in the same way that the original IB problem is. So there, in addition to this, there are the other two terms that enforce the rules of probability that are not so interesting. But you have to iterate them all. Okay, so to summarize on one slide, the stochastic IB encoder follows from this cost function, while the deterministic DIB follows from this one. So these aren't maybe the most useful names, so you might want to call this channel coding with relevance, and this one source coding with relevance. So that's the solution to this DIB problem. How does it work on data? So just like with IB, the DIB solutions can be visualized in if you like a DIB plane where you plot compression versus relevance, we can plot IB and DIB solutions in both IB's preferred plane and DIB's preferred plane. IB will be optimal in the IB plane, DIB in the DIB plane, but we can look and compare them. So we generated some synthetic joint distributions, P of XY, and ran some experiments. Here's a typical example that you get. On the left is the IB plane, on the right is the DIB plane. Each dot is a single fit with a different beta. The red are DIB, the blue are IB. And the algorithms perform very, very similarly, almost identical in the IB plane, but they do something that's very, very different in the DIB plane. Let's see. So, in the DIB plane, the curve looks as you might expect if you had more points, growing monotonically. But here, IB seems to be while you increase the amount of relevant information, you're sitting at this very, very high level of the entropy of T, because it doesn't really seem to care. We didn't ask it to minimize H of T, so it's not doing that. You might wonder why it's doing it. And there's one way of seeing that. If you want to have no information, there are two ways, kind of qualitatively different ways to get no information. One is to have the entropy of T just be zero, so you just map everything to a single cluster, which is what DIB does down here. Or you could map just randomly. Everything is completely random, so the entropy of T is the same as the noise entropy, but these are non-zero. And that's what IB is doing if you don't tell it not to. Since it's agnostic, we thought maybe it's doing this because of how we initialize the problem. So I said it's not a convex problem. So we thought maybe if we initialize the q of t given x closer and closer to a delta function on one cluster, we'll be able to move this IB curve over. And you can do that to some extent as you make the initialization increasingly peaky. This doesn't change anything in the IB plane. You're always getting a sort of somewhat optimal curve in the IB plane, but you're moving closer and closer to what the optimal DIB is over here. But you know, even with our best effort, IB is still you know, underperforming compared to DIB in the DIB plane. So you know, the two methods have similar behaviors when you look in the IB plane, but DIB seems to perform much better in terms of its own own cost function. And this depends on the data set that you used, that we used, but you know, and we're doing experiments to see how widely this holds, but it seems suggestive. The last thing I wanted to mention is that you know, maybe due to the smaller solution space that it has to search through, we found that the DIB fits took far less time than the IB fits, about 1 to 2 orders of magnitude. So this is just the CDF of the IB fit times and the CDF of the DIB fit times. The numbers don't really mean anything. So if you look at the ratio, you can see that about half of the DIB fit times finished at least 10 times faster than their IB counterparts. And about a quarter finished 50 times faster. And this certainly can vary by data set and by the convergence conditions, but the speed up is certainly seems encouraging. So what I told you is that we propose a new cost function for extracting relevant information based on source coding instead of channel coding. One consequence of this is that we end up with a deterministic encoder instead of a stochastic one. We find that we get non-trivial differences, especially in the DIB plane, when we compare this on some sample data. And we get a big speed up when we run DIB as opposed to IB. Finally, in solving DIB, we had to solve this this intermediate case of arbitrary alpha, and one thing we're working on now is thinking about what that could be useful for. So the way this problem is formulated, you have the joint distribution of P of X and Y. In real life, you don't actually have that, you have data. So you might worry about overfitting if you just use a plug-in estimate for what that joint distribution is. And the encouragement of stochasticity in IB may essentially be helping you regularize, similar to dropout in neural networks. And maybe there's an optimal value of alpha that's intermediate between 0 and 1 for different amounts of data. And if you have infinite data, DIB is best. If you have very little, IB is best. All right, so let me thank Pankaj and DJ and take questions.
Thanks, David, for this talk. So yeah, so we have lots of time.
Could you motivate or give examples of applications where DIB will be a more useful cost function than IB?
They're both motivated in principle by some sort of physical constraint, whether you're talking about the constraint of a channel or the constraint of the size of your representation. So in that sense, it really depends on the domain. I'm trying to argue here that that it seems in our experiments so far that DIB and IB perform very similarly when you try to solve the IB problem, but that DIB is much faster. So for that reason, even if you wanted to solve IB, you might want to do DIB instead.
So it does not depend on specific domain of application per se. You're saying this is generically any place where one applies IB, this will just do something similar.
I would hope so. So I don't know that, but in everything we've done so far, it seems to be the case.
So we went by a little fast, and maybe I didn't catch things right, but it looked to me like the first criterion, the IB criterion, place some value on keeping information about X, whereas your criterion doesn't care about keeping information about X. It just wants to have, only cares about that insofar as it's relevant to Y, and aside from that, just wants to have a small representation of the information that's relevant to Y. Is that an accurate characterization?
Yep, that's you got it exactly.
Okay, thanks. So it seems like they really, you might have motivation to use one or the other in different settings.
Yeah, depending on the physical problem at hand, you might want to constrain the size of the channel from X to T or the size of the representation of T.
Thanks.
Near the start of your talk, you mentioned that something like a deep neural net might be useful when your data has some kind of critical distribution. In the case of the Ising model, it seems reasonable to understand what that is. But in other real-life contexts where one uses deep learning, could you motivate what you mean by that statement?
What I mean by the data looking critical?
Exactly.
So there are various things that you can do. One thing that might rest well with you is you can take your data and you can fit an Ising model to it. You can, you know, imagine you have all these pixels and you can fit GIJs, fit a pairwise Ising model to it. And once you have this model of the data, you can put a fictitious temperature in and compute things like the specific heat. And what people find when they do this is that the specific heat has a peak at T equals one, which is what the actual distribution is, which indicates that the images that you were studying with, you know, look critical from that perspective. There are other approaches that you can take. They all, this doesn't directly speak to it, but they all have lots of scale-free correlations and stuff like that as well.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank David again.